I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
I was told to suit up when I speak, so most of the time I listen to directions, so that's what I did. This is my wedding, funeral, and speaking suit. It's well-rounded. I'm going to read something out of the big book to get started, start off on the right track. Page 29. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And what I used to be like was a bundle of energy. I wish I had half that energy now. But I always got in trouble. I was the youngest of five and the runt of the litter, so I can take a licking and keep on ticking. Some of my earliest memories are of feeling like I didn't fit in. I kind of felt like I didn't even fit in my own family. And I don't remember my first drink because my parents gave me alcohol when I was a baby to put me to sleep. And now they call it child abuse. Then they call it... I needed to be abused, I tell you what. The first drink I can remember having, I was 8 years old and I went to a wedding that my parents were at. And everybody was leaving half glasses. And even at 8 years old, that drove me crazy. I was like, how can you leave half a glass? So everybody that left a partial, I finished. You know, and I drank a little of this and that and a lot of champagne. And I remember being able to entertain people and making them laugh. And I felt like I fit in and I felt like I was a part of something. And I wanted to experience that feeling again as soon as possible. And I said I was 8. Actually, I was 12. I got my timeline off a little bit. But everybody thought it was funny that that little kid was drunk and staggering around like an old-timer. My sobriety date is March the 6th, 1986. I was 23 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was an old soul. My first day of first grade, I got sent home from school. I knew all the words people weren't supposed to know, and I wasn't afraid to use them. And I was that kid that if you dared him to do it, it was as good as done, you know, regardless. And I was an attention seeker, and even bad attention was better than none at all. And that's the only kind of attention I got at home because my parents had been there and done that with four kids before me. So they were old hands at my ways, and I didn't get away with much. Not much. My story includes drugs. I keep them at a minimum with respect to the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, but if it was out there, I did it. And I can relate to Bill's story. I have people that I sponsor go through Bill's story and write a T next to the sentence where they thought like Bill, an F next to the sentence where they felt like Bill, and a D next to the sentence where they drank like Bill. And what that does is it helps them to relate to somebody from the 30s that was a stockbroker and had a different background than I had, but I could surely relate to him. And the part of Bill's story I could really relate to, damn, this thing's on wheels. Fixing to roll out from under me. The part of Bill's story I could really relate to was the part where it said a doctor brought a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. And that was me. If it said don't take it with alcohol, then that meant pour it on. You know, my family is wrought through with alcoholism, but not everybody in my family is an alcoholic. For example, my grandmother came over. She was about 90 years old, and my dad poured her a little glass of wine. And she poured it up, drank it down like an old pro, one good shot. And he said, "Mother, would you like another one?" She goes, "No, I'm starting to feel it." And that drove me crazy. When I'm starting to feel it is when it's time to pour it on. I have the obsession and the allergy. And the obsession dooms me to take the first drink, and the allergy dooms me to keep on drinking. That's what makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows, as described in the doctor's opinion. Where alcohol was concerned, I was strangely insane, like they like to say, The definition of insanity in the big book is the inability to differentiate the true from the false. And that's my story. That's my story in a nutshell right there. The true is I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink like other people. The false is the lie that I tell myself it won't hurt me or it'll be different this time. So I qualify in that respect. Like I said, I was 23 when I got here, and I was at the end of my rope. My parents stuck me in a treatment center, and I saw people in there. They brought Alcoholics Anonymous in from the outside, and I saw the look in people's eyes. And I'd hear them talk. Their message had depth and weight, which is experience and solution. I'd hear them talk, and I'd know they had the same experience I had, and then I'd hear them continue to talk, and I'd know they had found a way out. And I wanted that. And the look in people's eyes attracted me to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous and made me want this thing. And then they gave out the white chips, and I noticed everybody clapped when you picked up a white chip. I didn't know what the hell it meant. I just knew everybody clapped, and I liked attention. As much as I liked it then, I don't like it now, but... Anyway, so I got up and got a white chip every time they handed them out. And I was walking up there to get my fourth white chip. I'm in a treatment center and not using, but I keep picking up white chips. And I hear this lady go, "What is that a-hole doing?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "You only pick up a white chip if you started drinking again." And so... Next three times they gave out chips, I walked up and gave one back. Till I only had one white chip. So I can't say I've only gotten one white chip, but I can say I haven't had a drink since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's not by virtue. That's by necessity. I weighed 149 pounds when I got here due to little bit of alcoholism and a whole lot of other substances that we don't talk about much in here, but I believe in the doctor's opinion where it says we can't safely use alcohol in any form. For me, that's fixed pill, powder, or drink. I can't take a mind-altering substance and expect to have a spiritual experience or a relationship with God. When I was in my teens, I was a weekend warrior. And I'd steal my dad's car and go to the skating rink. He had this equipment yard. I grew up on 40 acres. And he had this equipment yard that had all his spare cars and trucks and bulldozers and stuff on it. I'd walk over to the equipment yard, and he had a chain strung out across the driveway where you couldn't drive out, and I'd drive up to that chain, lift it up, and drive under it. And one night I did that, and I turned the lights on, and there's my dad standing there, "Damn it, Tom." I thought that was my name growing up, was "Damn it, Tom." So I put it in reverse, drove back up to the chain, and drove the car under it, and that was pretty much the end of that. But when I went to high school, I started with drugs and other substances, and I can remember that just sped up my getting here. Alcohol will get you here if you don't die, but drugs will get you here just a little bit quicker. And I was the test case. Remember those commercials about Mikey likes it? Let's see if Mikey likes it. That's what they did with me. When some new thing came out, they went, "Let's give it to Tom and see if he likes it." So I ran away from home and pawned a shotgun so I could get some pot and some LSD. And these were double dips, double hits of blotter. And this guy held it in his hand and he put it in my hand. And they're all going, "Give me one, give me one." It's like three or four people in the car, and I just went. So the first time I ever did it, I did 8 double dips, and I tripped all weekend. I sat on the couch helplessly and watched them do the last of my drugs. And then I woke up about 5 in the morning and started doing theirs. And I figured they helped themselves to mine, I could help myself to theirs. And I got run off for that and went back home. But anyway, if you don't think Alcoholics Anonymous is divinely inspired, it was started by a broken-down proctologist and a New York stockbroker. As a matter of fact, Dr. Bob, before he got sober, went to get the oil changed in his car. And he walked up to the counter to sign the receipt, and he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a rectal thermometer. And he goes, "Oh, my God." They said, "What's wrong?" He goes, "Some asshole's got my pen." I tell a joke, not for you, but for me, so I can loosen up a little bit. But I remember when I got put in that treatment center. Let me back up a little bit. When I was like 16 years old, I was sitting in my room with a bag of dope and a bottle of liquor. And I remember thinking, normal people just don't lock themselves in their room in the dark and drinking drug like this. And I said a little prayer, and I made a full concession to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I said, "If you help me out of this, I'll help others." And I didn't even know what I was asking for was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went on to what was my bitter end 7 years later, sitting in a dark closet after downing a bottle of liquor and a handful of pills, trying to commit suicide. After I finished that bottle of liquor, I remember sitting in that closet thinking, nobody's got the problems I got, and I'm hopeless, and it's always going to be like this. After I finished with the bottle of liquor, I told myself that I had really effed up, that I didn't really want to die, and I took enough pills to kill a horse. But there wasn't a phone in my house. And so I lived in an apartment complex, and the phone was down by the pool, and I was long away from being able to walk down there. So I crawled out of that closet to the bed and laid myself face down, because I knew if I laid face up, I might choke on my own vomit like Jimi Hendrix did. my roommates came home and found me and called my dad, and they put me in the hospital to have my stomach pumped, and this doctor came to talk to me, and I knew that doctor could sign me in. So I went and signed myself in GMHI. It's no longer there, Georgia Mental Health Institute. I used to say I came from J-A-I-L and G-M-H-I. So I signed myself in. That way I could walk out of there 11 days later against medical advice and sign myself out, and that's what I did. I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't at the bitter end just yet. But I reached that end, sitting alone in my dark bedroom, looking out the windows, knowing people were looking back. And, I was almost too paranoid to even look out the window. And I knew people were out to get me, and I figured all these gangsters were out to get me. And what was out to get me was the meth monster. Nobody was really out to get me. I was out to get myself, and I realized that, and my parents put me in a treatment center, and I spent 34 days in that 28-day treatment center, and they said after 34 days, we want you to do another week, and bear in mind, this is a 28-day treatment center, and I'm on my 34th day, so sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And they wanted me to do another week, and I told them I was out of money. So all of a sudden, I was healthy enough to go to a halfway house. And I went to this halfway house, and I couldn't keep my hands off the women. And I had a little girlfriend on the side, and they found out about it. And they had a house meeting that night, and they said, "You've been he-ing and she-ing, when can you leave?" And I jumped up and said, "How about right now?" And they said, "Hold on, sit down here a minute, and let's talk about this." And those people, that I didn't like them, and they didn't really like me. But they told me there was nothing that I had to use over, that I didn't have to use over any of that stuff, and that really hit home with me. They were carrying the message to me whether they liked me or not. And that was my first taste of unconditional love in Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't like me, but they loved me because I was one of them. So I got out of there and went to another halfway house and got another girlfriend. And this time I didn't get caught. I wasn't one that always played by the rules. And they came to me during the day. I was one of the house managers there, and they came to me during the day and said, "Somebody's been he-ing and she-ing. They're going to get kicked out tonight." And I went, "Oh my God, here we go again." And so we had the house meeting, and it was somebody else that was getting kicked out. And they said, "What do you think about this?" I said, "You don't have to use over any of this stuff." I got to carry the message that was carried to me. And I lost my license through a couple of technical violations that I just didn't think were right. You know, I'm different. I became a habitual violator because I kept driving without my license. And finally, I bought a motorcycle so I could outrun the cops every time they got near me. And this is with like 2 years of sobriety. So sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I got in more trouble after I quit drinking than I did when I was drinking. If you sober up a horse thief, what you've got is a sober horse thief. But hopefully, when he sobers up, he quits stealing. Not my story. So I got stopped one night, and I looked at this cop getting out of his car, and I said, "As soon as he gets halfway to this motorcycle, I got caught in traffic is what happened. I couldn't run. I said, as soon as he gets halfway to this motorcycle, I'm hauling ass. And he stopped and he reached in his car and pulled out the PA microphone and says, turn that damn engine off. So I was popped. And I was to go to court in the same courtroom I had been to like three other times for the same thing. And the guy that one of the co-founders of my home group was a DeKalb County judge, and this was in DeKalb County, so I got him as my representative. And when we walked in that courtroom, the solicitor jumped up and said, that's him. He's not going to quit driving. I want him to do 4.5 years. And BJ looked at that guy and goes, I think he needs to go to boot camp. And he opened up a folder and they signed some forms and that was it. That was all I got, was 3 to 6 months in Zell Miller boot camp chopping down trees. And when I got out, I quit driving for a year and got my license back, and I've been okay with that ever since. But I was in a little trouble, and I went to my probation officer, and he said, have you been drinking? I should throw your ass in jail. And the thought that crossed my mind was, no, I'll start drinking before I go back to jail, though. And I jumped up. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to an AA meeting. I'm not thinking straight. And I went in this meeting, and that they taught me about putting conditions on my sobriety. I can't put any conditions on my sobriety. I need to stay sober no matter what. I can't say if this happens or that happens, I'll drink. I just can't do it. I'll lose every time because I'll get in a debate with myself, and no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, so I'll use every time. When I went to my parents to get some money they were holding for me till they could learn to trust me, they were holding my money, and I told them I was in trouble and I needed some money to go to court. And the first thing out of their mouth was, have you been drinking? And I was highly offended. I mean, I had 2 years of sobriety, and they still didn't trust me. Never mind I wasn't acting right, but they still didn't trust me. So I hopped on that motorcycle that I didn't have a license for, and I sped over to the NABA club, and they were just starting the 545 meeting. And this guy named Roland was the discussion leader. And he could say stuff and get away with saying stuff that most people get punched in the mouth for. And he said, does anybody have anything they need to say? And I went, I need to say something. My parents don't trust me. And I told the story, and he goes, he started laughing just like JJ's laughing. He walked over. He did the meeting Phil Donahue style. I'm dating myself now. He walked around standing up calling on people. And he walked over and bent down in my face and started laughing. I said, I don't see what's so damn funny. He goes, all they've got to go on is your track record. And every day that you're sober and doing the right thing, you're building a new track record. And I took that to heart. I took that to heart. I straightened out my ways a little bit. When I got to the NABA club, I went through my first halfway house on the south side of Atlanta, and then I came up to the north side, and I went to the NABA club in DeKalb County, and there was an old bald-headed man there that was nuts, but he sure sounded good to me. He had 10 years of sobriety, and it sounded like an eternity. And when he shared, I really got a lot out of what he shared. I really related to him. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he agreed to, and he was my sponsor till the day he died about 10 years ago, and then I got Harry to be my sponsor. I remember calling him when I was in this halfway house. And I was bored as hell. And what that meant was I didn't have any chaos or tragedies or shit going on in my life that I drew energy from. And I called him up, told him I was bored, gave him a graphic description of my condition. And he goes, "Sounds like serenity to me," and hung up the phone on me. And he had fun with me. He took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it changed my life. I worked the steps slowly. I don't do that with people today, but then I did because I was scared to death to do that four step. I hung out on the first three steps for a year. And this girl and I had been dating and living together, and she moved out after my first birthday, 2 weeks after my first birthday. And I was sitting alone in the house that night. My roommates were all out, and I said, "I'm glad there's no liquor in the house. I'd be drinking right now." And I called my sponsor, and he said, "It's time to start writing." And I stayed up all night and did my four step. And the next day, he had something, another commitment. So I took my fourth step down to the Triangle Club and held it up at the men's meeting and said, "I need to do a fifth step with somebody." And three or four people volunteered, and I talked to them all, and I picked one that I felt kind of comfortable with, and I did my fifth step with him. And I really take it to heart when they say, when anyone anywhere reaches out, I want the hand of AA to be there. For that, I'm responsible. Anytime I've ever put my hand out, the hand of AA was there. But it wasn't always the first person I reached out to. Sometimes it was the second or third or fourth, but I've always been able to get a response. Now, I've gone through some things alone since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous, but only when I chose to. Only when I chose to. And I wouldn't know that guy if he was sitting in a room today. That wasn't a regular meeting that I attended, and I didn't go back. But I'd like to think he's still sober today, because one of the backbones of my sobriety is helping others. It works when all other activities fail. Bill Wilson talks about his first year and a half, during which he found little work. He was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment that nearly drove him to drink. But he said he'd go to a hospital and sit down and work with another alcoholic, and he'd be relieved of that stuff. And that's how it works. When I don't have time to worry about my crap, everything's good. The book says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So it's not a selfish program, it's a selfless program. It's a program for selfish people, they used to say in the treatment centers. And somebody mixed it all up and said it's a selfish program, and they started saying that, but I wholeheartedly disagree. Now, if it's a program for selfish people, I qualify. I qualify 10 times over. The first time my selfishness was pointed out to me was when I was in that treatment center. I had a Duck Dynasty beard, and my parents brought a shave kit in. And I went in the bathroom for like 45 minutes trimming and shaving and doing all that, and just left them sitting out there by themselves. I didn't even give it another thought. And when I came out, they were gone. And the counselor said, "You selfish SOB. They brought you that stuff, and then they sat here and waited on you, and you couldn't think of anything but yourself." And it was pointed out to me, and I began to see that, and I saw it through the step process, and We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I made that concession when I was 16 years old. There was never any doubt in my mind that I was an alcoholic or that I drank alcoholically. Thankfully, that hasn't been a part of my story. I don't doubt whether I belong here. I know I do. I've earned my seat. And, you know, but when I was working with my first sponsor on the step process, we got to step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, and sanity is defined in the 12 and 12 as soundness of mind. And that was pretty easy for me to work. And the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. He said, "Where are you at with that God thing?" And I said, "I know two things about God. There is one, and He's out to get me." And He said, "Well, you're right on one count. There's two things you need to know about God. There is one, and you're not it." And I used the group as my first higher power. And it led me back to the God of my childhood, but I saw Him in a different light. And in the church that I was raised in, they haven't changed their message in hundreds of years. But I went in there and I heard a whole different message. I heard about a kind and loving God, and who allows me to be human and make mistakes. And that's the kind of God I wanted, and that's the kind of God I have. My God doesn't test me. Most of my trials and tribulations are of my own making. Then I did 4 and 5, like I told you, right after my first year birthday. And I got on with the rest of the steps, 6 and 7, the defects of character, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. And I usually have my guys read a book when we get to 6 and 7. It's called Drop the Rock. And it's a whole book about character defects. They now have it in the literature cabinet back there. And it's a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics. And it's sold over 250,000 copies. And they're just selling to people in AA. So it's been a well-received book, and it's really important in my life. And they talked about different stories about 6 and 7 in there. And this guy talks about this woodsmith that made this beautiful carving. And they asked him how he did it, and he said he stripped away everything that wasn't that piece, that it was there the whole time. And there's another Joe and Charlie story in that book about this guy went to sell this piece of furniture, and he had it appraised, and he realized it was oak, and it was a valuable antique. And so he went to stripping on it and working on it, and made it into, it was junk when he started, and made it into this beautiful piece of furniture. And he said, "That's what it was all the time. I just stripped away the layers." And that's kind of the way it is with 6 and 7. We strip away the layers of denial and sloth, lust, anger, pride, envy, greed, gluttony. That's the 7 deadly sins. So I had plenty to work on. Plenty. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. It says we have a list of people we harmed. We made it when we took inventory. So that's my harms list from step 4, and some of my resentment list and some other stuff. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The word amend A-M-E-N-D is not in the big book. The word amends is in there a ton of times. And the difference is, amend means to change by taking away from or adding to. Amends means, the big book definition of amends is to repair the damage. If I run over somebody's mailbox, I don't just owe him an apology, I owe him a mailbox. That's part of my direct amends. So, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. If I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear during the day that it talks about, it says continue to watch for that stuff. That means when I'm done with 6 and 7, I still have that stuff. It just doesn't drive me today. I'm not driven by it. I'm not a slave to my character defects. I actually have a filter that allows me to not act on them today. And I didn't have that filter when I got here. Not even close. If I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and I clear those up when they crop up, then I'm not wasting hours of the day that might have been worthwhile. And then it says on step 11, where were we selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? Same four things. When we do our review at night, it asks us seven simple questions. And if I'm working 10 and clearing it up as it crops up, then my review at night is short, constructive, and to the point, and I sleep like a baby. So, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's what I do today. There's a whole chapter. Working with others is mentioned 52 times in the big book, and then there's a whole chapter on it. So they must have thought it was important. The big book doesn't go over dozens of ideas a few times. It goes over a few ideas dozens of times. And some of those ideas are self-knowledge won't fix it. I can't drink like other people can. I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Those are some of the ideas that it goes over. And I'm going to read something and finish up here. I like to finish with this from page 164 of the big book. This describes the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in a nutshell. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you. Amen.